Okay, well, welcome to How to Create Legendary Promotions, Keys to Harnessing the Genius Ideas and Strategies of the World's Greatest Admin, with me, Bob Bly, and those of you who came here from the emails in my newsletter. Craig, there is, I believe, a way on Free Conference to start the to stop the ringing, but you're in control of the conference. You might take a look at that. You know, I know it's, I don't want to rush it, but normally there's a way to stop the bell, and it's going to drive people crazy if we can.
Just turn it off. Thank you for mentioning that.
Yeah, great. Thank you. So, you get my newsletter, and you know who I am. I've been a copywriter, a direct response copywriter, for almost four decades, not quite. And I just absolutely love it. And I've taught seminars and spoken at conferences, written for a lot of the major players and some of the smaller ones in direct response in fields like health, financial, B2B. And Craig is one of my clients and certainly a favorite. Craig Simpson, I could introduce him and speak for an hour, but Craig, why don't you tell the people a little bit about yourself and your experience.
Sure. And I'll let you know, Bob, on the notes, I guess the bells ringing in are people joining, and it's a preference I should have set prior to the call. I can't change it now, it's telling me. So I apologize, everyone, for the people dinging in. So we're just going to have to deal with it for today. So I got my start about 20 years ago in direct mail marketing, and I worked for a large financial publisher, and I was very fortunate to get in on the ground floor and learn kind of the ropes of direct mail marketing before the internet, before all the different opportunities we have with media today. And it gave me a real good foundation on direct response and the fact that we're going to spend money and we've got to account for every dollar where it's spent. It's not something we can do for free. We actually have to pay for it, so therefore we better make sure we do it right and we put every effort into making that campaign a success. And so that kind of got my start 20 years ago. Since then, I've mailed over 300 million people, sold hundreds of millions of dollars in products and services, and I still send out, you know, a few hundred different campaigns every single year. So we're heavily and aggressively using direct marketing every single week, every single day.
Interestingly, guys who are listening, what Craig said about money, there's a general agreement among knowledgeable marketers that people like Craig and Brian Kurtz, who grew up in print, direct mail, and other people like Melvin Powers in newspaper and magazine advertising, Robert Ringer also, they know more. And the reason that we had to know more is because it was so expensive. If you test a pay-per-click campaign, you might spend $1,000. You know, you can test Facebook ads for $20. If we did a direct mail test, 25,000 pieces, and it didn't work, we'd be out many thousands of dollars. So there was a need to get it right, and so those who grew up, not saying internet marketing people don't know what they're doing. On the contrary, there's some very brilliant internet marketers. But people who grew up in the print, because it costs so much and the stakes are bigger, you know, had to be at a somewhat sharper level, or at least that's my opinion. So let me dive in now. Craig, you recently wrote a book called Advertising Solutions, where you and Brian Kurtz of Boardroom distilled the tips, the advice, and the wisdom of half a dozen of the top marketers / copywriters of all time. And I noticed that most of these guys are dead. Robert Collier, Gary Halbert, John Caples, and I know some younger people, maybe not on this call, but I know some younger people would say, well, why don't you have, Seth Godin David Meerman Scott. So why are these marketing legends of long ago still relevant today and crucial to my current promotions? And are any of their strategies still worthwhile? And if so, which?
Yeah. Good question. You know, one of the things when I set out to do this was I really wanted to take a look back to see, well, first of all, my question of, well, is it still effective today, you know? And so are these old principles that were taught from Claude Hopkins back in 1907, do they still apply today? And so when I started doing this research for this book, I found out these did, and we'll dive into some of those. And so when I thought, okay, who can I pick from to write this book, and there's, you know, dozens and dozens of what we consider legendary marketers out there, I decided that I wanted to go with those who have passed away and who had provided great content over their life, meaning they had written ads and samples that we could get our hands on. They had written books and articles that we could review and read. And I just felt like that was important for us to always go back to our roots as to where this started, where direct marketing started, and see how we can apply it to today. And the thing is that products and business models change over time. We know that. But human nature hasn't really changed. The same thing that motivates somebody to respond and buy today is really the same as it was 100 years ago. And because of that, that means the core principles in getting people to respond haven't changed. And as we talk through this today, Bob, you'll see, and as you know, we'll talk through some things that were used 100 years ago and are still used today, and I think it will shock some people and surprise some, and hopefully it'll make everyone want to research deeper into these legends and what these old-time marketers could teach us.
Well, I'm going to ask you about some of those that I know personally that you do use, and Claude Hopkins in Scientific Advertising agrees with you, you know, that marketing, new marketing channels pop up, and we're flooded with that today. You know, there's Snapchat, there's Periscope, there's Meerkat, these social media things, you know, and so the channels and formats are changing, but as Hopkins said, echoing you, human psychology has not changed in 10 centuries. And the core of copywriting and direct marketing is human understanding, human psychology. So that given, we promised specifically on our sign-up page, which you provided me a bullet, three ways to hook your prospects and pull them into your message. Whenever you state a number in your copy, people become curious because they want to know what the three is. If you say seven things, they start thinking of the items in their mind. If they can't think of as many as seven, they only come up with four, five, or six, they want to read or take or get your program to find out what seven are. And if they do come up with seven, they want to know if theirs are the same as yours. So what are the three ways to hook your prospects and pull them into your message?
Well, I think there's more than three, but there are many ways, and we just put, you know, three there, and we'll talk about a few of them. But I think one of the things that we start off with is we've got to find a way to grab their attention. And I want to talk about something Robert Collier talked about. He called it the tricks of showmanship. And really, the concept is when we put an ad in front of somebody, and whether it's online or offline, we have to square them in the shoulders and basically get them to focus just on us and get their attention long enough that they're willing to read our message. Now, back in the 1920s, Robert Collier was the first person that we know of to use a $1 bill mailing. Now, Gary Halbert used it, and he's pretty famous for it, but Collier used it in the 1920s for a children's hospital. It was a fundraising piece. And basically, he mailed out the dollar, and he asked the recipients to return the dollar and add more of their own money to help out. Now, the response rate he received was a 90% response rate. Now, putting a dollar bill on a mailing in 1920s would be probably the equivalent to putting a $20 bill on the mailing for us today. And I think the point is he got their attention. He did something above and beyond, something extraordinary that grabbed the attention of the prospect and made them read the letter, and obviously it motivated response. So that's one key area. Another one would be what we call, David Ogilvy calls, the big idea. And Bob, I'm sure you're familiar with David Ogilvy's famous Rolls-Royce ad. Do you remember that ad?
It is possibly my favorite ad of all time, and the headline for those listening is, quote, "At 60 miles per hour, the loudest sound in this new Rolls-Royce is the electric clock, end quote.
Yes, and it's fabulous. And the interesting thing is Ogilvy found that from researching engineering reports and reading every detail he could about the Rolls-Royce. And because of his research, he found this one little note that the engineer had made, and it was just kind of a comment the engineer made about, hey, the clock being the loudest thing in the car at 60 miles an hour. And he took that and turned it into this great campaign. But the point that David Ogilvy made was coming up with these big ideas so that once we've got their attention, now we've got to keep them engaged. And usually that thing that's keeping them engaged is something of interest or intrigue that makes them want to take the next steps and keep on reading all the way through the sales letter. So whenever we're writing a marketing campaign, whether online or offline, we really need to think about the prospect and what is going to hold their interest and make them want to continue reading our message. If we focus on us and our business and how great we are, we're going to lose them. If we focus on benefits and the things that it can do for them, then it's going to keep them engaged. And if we come up with some amazing, great, big idea, then it's not only going to keep them engaged, but it's going to motivate them to respond.
Yeah, I'll give you a variation of the dollar. I was approached by a janitorial service years ago, before email, to write a paper sales letter to generate leads, just a one- or two-page letter, so they could get more office complexes to clean. And their offer was, we'll do the first one for free. And normally people say, well, free is the most powerful word. But I did something different. We glued a penny to the upper right corner of the letter and said, call us and we will come in and clean your entire office complex, no matter how big, for just one penny, dot, 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 and we've even enclosed the penny. And it worked very well.
I love it. I think this is a great example of things that were brought up years ago, 100 years ago, that are still being effectively used today. I mean, we're talking about a dollar bill that was used back then. You could also talk about, you know, they used lumpy objects back then, too. They would mail keys, and they would mail pictures of elephants or animals or different things. Robert Collier even tried perfuming hundreds of letters by spraying them with perfume, so when they showed up in the mailbox, they had this special scent about them. Right, so there's a lot of things that aren't that we think may be new, but they're not. They've been around forever, and there's a lot of ways that we can use them and apply them today.
Yeah, in the Reese Witherspoon movie Legally Blonde, she gives the law firm a resume, and he sniffs it. He goes, "This smells." She goes, "Yes, I gave it a fragrance. Pretty good idea, don't you think?" So it gets attention. I knew a guy who did mailings as to warm up prospects so that sale, it was a construction firm, and he wanted to sell high-end business, you know, commercial construction. So the salespeople would call each lead, but first they'd send out the mailing, and the mailing was a letter with a brick, a red brick with the person's business card silkscreened on the brick. So when he called, and they would get the assistant, the screening person, the receptionist, the secretary, and he or she would say, well, can I tell them who's calling? And every salesperson was trained to say, tell them I'm the guy who sent him the brick. And it worked.
That's outstanding. I love it.
Yeah, it wasn't mine, but it was a great promotion. So you talked about David Ogilvy and the big idea. Another of his most famous, do you remember the man in the Hathaway shirt?
Oh, yeah.
And what made it stand out is he had the guy, it's totally illogical, he had the guy wear an eye patch.
Yeah.
And it was just distinctive. So next on our list, and neither of us, I think, has a degree in psychology. You don't, do you?
No, not at all.
Yeah, I don't either. mine's in engineering. But you talk about the psychology not changing for 10 centuries. We promised them in our email the nitty-gritty psychology behind what gets prospects to listen, respond, and buy.
Sure.
Any more thoughts on that?
I'll give you a couple things. One I always like to tell a story about that Robert Collier talks about, and that is the story of the fisherman. Do you remember that one?
It's funny. I have a good memory for this, and I've read the Robert Collier letter book, but I don't remember.
Okay, so he tells the story of two fishermen fishing in the same pond, and one is a sports fisherman, and he's got the neoprene, the best waders, he's got the best booties, he's got the best, the really cool in style fishing vest and hat. He's got the nicest reel and rod and lure, and he's out there fishing in this pond, and he's not catching a thing. Now, on the same shoreline, just a little ways away, you've got a little boy in there, and he's got a stick and a string and a hook. And he's
now catching. I remember it, but I can't remember the outcome, so go ahead.
Okay, well, he's fishing, and he's catching fish all day long, and you're going, well, what's the difference between the boy with the stick who's got no gear and the guy who's got all the gear? The one big difference is the bait. And the bait is the thing that's catching the fish and reeling them in. Now, for us, when we're talking about, you know, the psychology of the prospect and what gets them to respond, what we're really talking about is the bait. What is ultimately going to get them to connect with you and motivate them to respond? And one of the key things to talk to and speak to is emotion. Now, emotion is talking about love and shame and vanity and fear. There's a whole bunch of different emotions. So let me give you an example. If you were an insurance agent and you're selling insurance to homeowners that would protect them from burglary and theft, if somebody comes mm-hmm. and burglarizes your house, they will recover the cost. Well, if you're doing that kind of message to a prospect, you're going to want to bring in the emotion of fear and talk about how crime is on the rise and how you really need to find a way to safeguard your possessions. Now, if you don't and somebody burglarizes your house, you can lose all this money. But if you want
to... Not to mention be really harmed if you wake up.
That's right. That's right. So you can take that emotion of fear and build into the sales copy to help motivate the prospect to respond. And the fear, the emotion, that's the bait. That's the thing. That's the thing in the pond that's making you stand out amongst everyone else who's selling the same product or service. Or, well, let me give one more example on this to help get the point across. You know, if you talk about going to a dentist, a lot of people don't enjoy the dental experience. It's uncomfortable. Sometimes people are fearful of it because it's painful. It's never a great experience. So if you're a dentist, you could use that emotion of fear and being uncomfortable and turn that into a way that you can connect with the prospects and get them to respond to you by saying things like, well, we're different. We offer comfortable chairs. We have earphones that you can listen to music. We have big screen TVs so you can watch TV. We have heated blankets. We provide all these amenities to make it comfortable for you and to make your experience a good one, right? So you're tying in emotion, and then you're using facts to offset that fear or that emotion. So that's the bait and the way to use that to your advantage.
When I was a kid, my dentist, before he injected the Novocaine, used nitrous oxide laughing gas, and I couldn't wait to get to the dentist. You got high from that. It was a lot of fun.
Well, they don't do that anymore, do they?
No, they don't do that anymore. And the reason, actually, is because some dentists got addicted to it and some died.
Oh, really?
Because they were just breathing it and not and getting oxygen deprived. Yep, that's why they did it. So next, classic techniques for killer ad copy from some of the world's most sought-after copywriters. You mentioned Robert Collier, Gary Halbert. So can you give me, maybe from the book, an example of a copywriting technique for one of the six greats you profile?
Sure. You know, Claude Hopkins gave, which is so funny because his book was written in 1907, he gave a great list of some key things that he believed should be in every single piece. And his concepts would work whether it's online or offline or TV or radio. And so they still are they very much apply to today. One of the things he talks about is we never want to make writing the piece some kind of brilliant writing that entertains so much that it distracts from what the actual offer is. And I think a great example of that is when we look at the Super Bowl commercials and we laugh at them and we think they're really funny and we can't wait to see more of them. But when the Super Bowl is over, we remember the commercial, but we don't remember what they were selling, because the writer of those commercials was focused on trying to create this brilliant piece of humor and entertainment, but failed to engage with the prospect and tell them what it is they're actually selling and get that point across. So one of, on Claude Hopkins' list, one of the top things that he would mention is that brilliance has no place in advertising, has no place in writing. You don't want to write just to entertain. You want to write to sell something. Another one would be that the language should be natural and simple. You want to write to an audience that they can understand you and they can feel exactly what you're saying. You don't want to write above them or make it sound like you're so much better than them. Instead, you really want to write on their level. One more is to never show off. You want to write with sincerity. Gary Halbert always says, write at a sixth grade reading level. We want to keep it simple and easy for people to read.
I mean, great example of it. I have written for certain companies, maybe you've had this too in your client list, where the company says, well, free is such a common and lowbrow word. Say complimentary. I tell them, first of all, half of America doesn't know what it means. They think you're giving a compliment. And free, everybody wants free. It works for everybody. You want stuff, you'd rather have it for free than pay for it. And they don't get that.
Yeah.
So use the small word. I mean, Mark Twain, who was a very successful writer in his day, said, I never write the word metropolis when I get paid the same 2 cents a word for writing city.
Oh, I love that. That's a great one. I wish I would have had that one to include in my book, because that's a really perfect example of what we're talking about here when we talk about to never show off in your writing. You know, write with sincerity, right? Make it easy. Make it simple. That's a great example.
Yeah, I love that one. So from Hopkins, my favorite example, do you know from Hopkins the Schlitz beer story?
I don't remember that one offhand. I remember something about it, but I don't remember it offhand.
His lesson was that to clients, it doesn't matter what you know or think or feel about the product. It matters what the market knows or thinks or feels. So he was hired to bring back a dying brand, Schlitz Beer, and he's walking through the factory, and he notices that there's bottles on poles with steam being shot up in them to clean them. And he says, wow, and the brewmaster, or the brewery, whatever they call the guy, says, no, don't put that, don't write that. Every freaking, beer maker does that. And he looked at the guy and says, but the public does not know that. And he wrote a whole campaign triggered from that. And the first headline was, beer so pure, we washed the bottles in live steam.
I remember that now. Yeah, that's a great example.
It's a great example. So how do you apply all of the knowledge in your book, and as you work, over time, you assemble these rules. How do you apply them to your current promotion? Do you sit there, Craig, do you have a five-page checklist? Do you just keep them in your mind? How do you apply them? How do you know which ones to use with which product or service or offer?
Well, one of the things I wanted to do in the book was to give lots of lists, and that way people can use it as kind of a guide. And for me, I have a list of different things, some of the things we've talked about here, where I just kind of look through and make sure that every single thing every single sales piece has some of these key things in it. It's tough to make every sales piece have, 50 different key points in it that you want to have covered, but if you can get the top 10 in there, then that's great. But I do have a list, and I think that it's always good to take a step back from whatever piece you're working on, and then take a fresh look at it with a new set of eyes, and try and go down and say, okay, did I talk directly to the prospect more about them than I am about myself? Did I grab their attention? Do I have a big idea in there? Do I have a built-in urgency? I want to make sure I've got as many things as we can. And, interesting, before this call, earlier today, you and I had a call about a client that we're working on. Mm-hmm. And one of the first things you did was in the headline, you changed it from something that was more vague to a very specific headline that addressed specific ailments. And we both were talking, we're saying, wow, that one change alone is going to increase the response of this piece. Now, by you taking a fresh look at it, stepping back, you were able to come up with this great idea that really is going to influence the response and change that. And so I think that's important for us, is to have our own list, take a step back from whatever you're working on, look at it with some fresh eyes, and then kind of go through your list and say, did I cover all these key areas?
Yeah, what's interesting, though, as you will agree, and you're the master of this, is you can, from your knowledge, think you know what's going to work, but we're not just going to mail the new mailing. We're going to test that against the old mailing. And why is that important to do? I mean, why not just, you come up with a better idea like we think we have for a new mailing, why not just throw the other one away and mail the new one?
Right. I love that. And, you know, one of the, John Caples was huge into testing. That's one of the things that he was famous for. And it's so important for us to constantly test. You know, all these marketers, they never, what we say, rested on their laurels. They never just stopped working on something because they had a home run. Instead, everyone was constantly trying to better and win with a new piece, a new, what we call a new control.
Can you explain what control means?
Yes. So a control would be a marketing piece that you've mailed out and you've seen success from, and it does so well that you decide to keep on mailing it. And that becomes the kind of the piece that you measure everything else up against. So you have your control web page or landing page, and now you're going to test it against a new one. Maybe you're just changing a headline, or maybe you're changing just the design or just the offer. But you usually change one major variable against what we call a control piece, the piece you mail often or use often. And that one variable, when you do the test, you'll determine whether or not it increases response or it decreases response.
I'm going to tell you something that I think is a great example. In the olden days, I had a client that we used direct mail to generate leads for expensive mainframe software. And the standard was 30-day free trial. And he got an idea. This wasn't mine. He took his control, which said 30-day free trial, and he whited out, it was before computers, this is how old it was, and he whited out the word trial and typed in the word use. So he tested 30-day free trial versus 30-day free use, and it increased response 15%, you know, from 1 to 1.15 or 1, you know, whatever 15% of 1 is. And the reason we concluded, you don't really know the reason, was that no one likes a trial, especially in software. You know, IT professionals, that means shutting down the computer and staying late at night. But if you're getting a product, you're going to use it. Why not use it free? Everybody wants that. And,
right.
And so simple change you wouldn't think would make a difference. You know, one word made him 15% more money.
Yeah, that's outstanding. Well, I've got five different testing ideas that John Caples mentions. He actually has 32 different ways to get more response. And I've listed those all in the book. But let me go over five, because I think these five are the ones that, you know, at the end of this call that you can take and go and use right away, because there's tremendous value in these. So is it okay if we go through these five, Bob?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay. Number one would be include testimonials. In every marketing piece that you do, whether it's a sales video or offline, online, TV, use testimonials. And not only use them, but if you've got a current piece that you've got that's your control and it's working well for you, try adding more testimonials. Try changing the position of where they're located. We had one mail piece where we just moved a testimonial from the middle of the sales letter to page 2, and that one change increased response by 30%. And it was such a powerful testimonial by the prospect seeing it up front, it helped boost response because it increased their enthusiasm as they read through the piece, and it helped motivate their response. So testimonials, I can't stress enough how important they are to a mail piece or online piece or video, whatever you're doing. So number one, use testimonials, find ways to use them even more, and try different locations. And Bob, I'm sure that's something that's one of your things that you always try and include in your pieces too.
Yeah, and it's funny. Some of the younger internet marketers today say to me, "Oh, they don't work because people assume they're fake." And my answer is, no, they don't, because people are smarter than you think, and they know full well that if you made it up and got caught, you can go to jail.
That's right. That's right. Okay, number two would be sweeten your offer, meaning add in another bonus, give away free shipping, add in an extra report, pile on those benefits. Do something to sweeten your offer, to make it more appealing. Making a simple change to your offer is another big thing that can help significantly increase your response. And I can't count the number of times where we've just made what we thought was a small change, and in the end result, it was significant in getting more people in the door. So sweeten the offer is another big one.
Now, you wrote this book, The Advertising Solution, with Brian Kurtz of Boardroom fame. And another guy at Boardroom, I won't name him, told me that his methodology was he would have so many bonuses that the cover price, and he's selling information products, newsletters, books, and reports, that the cover price of all the bonuses, if you have four or three or five or six, if you add them up, is greater than the cost of the product. So even if you don't like the product, the bonuses alone have paid your money back. So that's what he did.
Yeah, in fact, they had one marketing piece where they had 100 different free reports included.
They're not the first to do that, by the way. Do you remember Anwar Suleiman? He was a seminar promoter, and he also did that, but it was all in one publication. He did 72, and each page he called a mini report, and he had 72 pages.
Outstanding. Yeah, so adding just as simple as adding something to your offer will help increase response. Number three would be the guarantee, or making sure that, you know, there's no obligation with it. Anything we can do to break down the barriers between the prospect saying yes or no, anything we can do to make it easier for them to say yes is an advantage to us. So if we offer a money-back guarantee, or double your money-back guarantee, or some other kind of no-obligation, risk-free offer, That kind of language, as simple as it is, it can have a significant impact on your overall response rate. So it's super important that if you don't offer a guarantee, to make sure you find a way, a creative way to include one. And if you already have a guarantee in your offer, find ways to make it better. Find ways to make it sweeter. Find a way to make it stand out more. Maybe if it's a 30-day guarantee, make it a 90-day. If it's 90-day, make it a year. Find ways to make it even stronger.
I can give an example if we have time later.
Yeah, let's do it. Let's do it.
Okay, so I used to write a lot of ads, magazine ads, to sell books by mail order, and the deal was you read the book, and if you don't like it, you return it in 30 days, and you get a refund. Now, I write a lot of promotions selling ebooks, but the problem is you can't return an ebook. How would I know whether someone would, if I want them to print it out and send me the pages, they can still have it. So I came up with an offer where I said, if you're not happy with the ebook, let us know within 90 days. Also, you can change the terms, 30, 60, 90. Let us know within 90 days and we'll refund your money in full. And then I added the phrase, which I wasn't using, and you can still keep the ebook free with our compliments just for trying our product. That way, you risk nothing. And when we told them they could keep it, and they kept it anyway, but when we told them that, our average conversion rate online, this is online promotion, went up 18%.
That is outstanding. Oh, very cool. I love it. I love stories like that. And you know, with as many marketing campaigns as you've done and I've done, there's always something or some way we've seen one little change like this have an amazing impact on the overall response to the campaign. And that's something we should never give up on. We should never stop testing, never stop trying new things to try and find a ways to beat response and make our mailings and marketing campaigns more profitable.
So what's next on the checklist?
Okay, I got two more I'm going to give you.
Great.
And I love this one. This is so important. It's urge immediate action, meaning we want people to act right away. We need them to take action now, because here's the thing. If they're watching your online sales video and there's nothing in there to motivate them to respond now, they have the option to say, you know what, I will do this later. I'm going to go run some errands. I'm going to go take care of, you know, the dishes and the sink or the yard work, and then I'll get around to take, you know, doing this thing here. Now, if we allow them to procrastinate and not act now, then there's a very good chance that they're not going to do it at all, because as soon as they leave your message, your video, your mail piece, whatever it is, as soon as they leave it, they may never come back.
There's an old saying about that. Do you remember? A decision deferred is a decision never made.
That's right. Who said that, by the way? Do you remember who said that?
I do not remember.
That's a great one. Yeah, so urge immediate action. We need to have them respond now. It's got to be a limited time offer. Okay, the last one, Bob, is the one that I catch the most flack for, and I bet you do too. It is, and this comes from, you know, from John Caples from years ago. He found it to be true in the 50s and 60s and 70s, and I'm sure you found it to be true ever since then, and I have for the last 20 years as well. And that is, the old saying, the more you tell, the more you sell. Use long copy. If you have an online ad and it's one page, try increasing it to two. If you're mailing out a sales letter and it's four pages, make it six. Make it eight. If you're using a 30-minute video, try a 90-minute video. One of my most successful clients right now, we're taking an offline approach. We're driving, using direct mail, driving to an opt-in page, so offline to online.
Mm-hmm.
Once they opt in, they're watching a 90-minute video. Now, the conversion
rate. I'm going to interrupt you. A lot of people listening do not believe that. How is that possible?
Exactly, right? So the 90-minute video is getting a 20 to 25% conversion rate for people to buy a $97 product. Now, the video started out at 30 minutes, and then we added more to it, and then we added more to it. And every time we increased the length, the conversion rate went up. We started out at only getting 10% of the people to convert, and after getting to 90 minutes, we now have between 20 and 25%. And here's the thing, is the more time the prospect is engaged with you, the more committed they are to taking the next steps. So, of course, not everyone is going to watch the 90-minute video. Not everyone is going to read a 20-page or 40-page sales letter. But the ones that have a piqued interest, the ones that you've really engaged with, they're going to spend the time and they're going to read the entire sales message or watch the entire sales video. And that time of engagement is convincing them more and more and more that they need to do whatever it is you're going to ask them to do at the end of the piece. So I love the saying, the more you tell, the more you sell. It's huge. I'm trying to think of an occasion. I don't think I've ever seen where shorter copy works better than long. How about you, Bob? What's your take on this?
What's interesting is people listening, some of them, still do not believe you because they say, this is what they're thinking. Well, I would never watch a 90-minute video, and I hear that all the time. And the great copywriter Peter Betchell, I once said, and it always stuck with me in a meeting, I think it was with Boardroom when we were both there, he said, never let personal preference get in the way. It doesn't matter if you're listening and you're thinking, I would never watch. It doesn't matter what you would do. It matters that you can test the proposition in the real world, and the test tells you whether it will work or not, not your subjective judgment or personal opinion. So you should never base advertising decisions on taste or aesthetics.
Exactly.
Have we gone through the five?
Yep, those were the five.
Great.
So I think those are all strengths. I think that's a way that whatever marketing piece you currently have, take those five things and apply it to it and see if you can increase response. And I'd be shocked if you weren't able to.
So we promised on our registration page to tell them Gene Schwartz's unbeatable workflow technique to avoid writer's block in other creative businesses. And he, to my knowledge, is the person who invented this. So why don't you reveal it?
This is one of my favorite things to talk about. And to be honest, this is how I wrote this book. I do so many things by this formula. So Gene Schwartz, he talks about that he never feels like he was writing sales copy. He never really sat down with a blank sheet of paper or a blank computer screen. Instead, what he would do, and he was a big copywriter for publishers, people selling books and newsletters and things like that. And so he would always start out his work with research. He would read through the book three or four times, and he would highlight different areas and content and things that he'd like, and he would kind of just put them in a place. He would just grab stuff out. Now, if you're not writing to sell a book, maybe it's some kind of service that you offer, go through and just start writing down the key things that are important to you or to the prospect for that service. So he would start with gathering information. Now, he would set a timer for 33 minutes and 33 seconds. And he during that time, he would focus only on this one writing project. He wouldn't answer the phone. He wouldn't look at emails. He wouldn't go to the bathroom. He wouldn't do anything. But for 33 minutes and 33 seconds, he would work on this project. Now, he never worked on it in the way of, I'm going to write a headline in this time frame, or I'm going to come up with the right offer, the close. Instead, he would just arrange things. He would take his research and put them in order. He would type up different sentences and maybe rework them. But he didn't put pressure on himself to create a sales piece. Instead, he was just working on a project. Now, at the end of that time, the buzzer would go off and he would stop. Even if it was mid-sentence, he would stop working on it. And he would take a break and he would go get something to eat. He would play with the dog. He would get coffee, whatever he wanted to do. And then he would go back to work again. He would set the timer for 33 minutes and 33 seconds. And he would do that four or five times a day, and he wrote these brilliant sales letters. It didn't have anything to do with him sitting there focusing on the best headline. It had everything to do with him focusing for 33 minutes on a writing project and just reworking things until it felt right. Now, for me, when I had to go through thousands of pages of books and reports to write this book, I took this method that I read from him, and I would just work on the project 30 minutes at a time. And I was amazed at how much work I could get done when I just focused on this one thing. And I also didn't put pressure on myself to feel like I had accomplished anything. Instead, I was just working for one half-hour block. And I feel like it's brilliant. I think it's an easy way for all of us to work on copy, sales copy, or projects, or content, or whatever it may be.
Yeah, educational psychologists use this technique with children, and they call it chunking. Let the kids do homework. Let them take the lessons in bite-sized chunks. I happen to use 55 minutes myself, but it's the same. It's the same principle.
So now, for you, Bob, I'm curious. So you write for 55 minutes. Is that do you set a timer, or how do you go about it for your writing method?
I don't have a timer, although that's not a bad idea. I just have one of my clients. I think you know them. Is Successories, and they gave me as a little bonus a beautiful classic clock where you can see the gears in it. So it's right in front of me, and I have a little ledge on the wall in my office, so it's always within sight, right? You know, when I'm looking at the computer, I can see it out of the corner of my eye, so it's easy for me to keep track of whatever I'm doing. I'm using it now, so we're on track and on time for this session.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And I think out of all the writers I work with, I don't know anybody that produces more than you. I mean, the amount of sales letters that you can create in a short amount of time and content. And how many books have you written now, like 80-something books?
I just published my 90th book.
Jeez. So I don't get how – it still baffles me at how much work you get done. But your system obviously works.
Yeah, and that's a whole other subject. But Schwartz's system also works, and you and I both use a variation of it. Now, I want to make sure we got to all our promises. So also in our registration page, we promised how to build trust and increase sales by connecting with your readers on a personal level. How do you do that? Because, you know, it's not one-on-one selling. You never see them. You don't know them.
That's right. So, and I want to remind everyone here, in just a few minutes here, we're going to have time for some questions.
This is actually the last item we didn't get to. So right after this, I want to do the Q&A.
Okay, perfect. So if you have a question while we're covering this last section here, press *6, and it's going to put you into a queue, and then we'll answer as many as we have time for, and it will prompt you, and it will tell you what to do next. So if you're listening in, you've got a question, press *6. So how do you connect with the prospect? You know, one of the things, if I were to pick one thing, Bob, that was a commonality between six legends who spanned over the course of 100 years, there's one thing, one word that just blew me away, that they all talked about this one thing over and over again. And that one word is research. David Ogilvy used to hop on a train in New York and go all the way to Chicago with the purpose of talking to people. Gene Schwartz used to go to movies, he would go to dinner, he would go to sit in a cab, just so that he could talk to people. He would listen how they would say things. He said that he would talk little and listen much. And the whole purpose of this research was so they could get intimately familiar with who their prospects were. They wanted to know what they were thinking, how they would say things, how they would phrase sentences. And the more they knew about the prospect, the better job they could do in creating their advertisements. David Ogilvy tells a story about the Dove soap. Do you remember the Dove soap story, Bob?
I sort of do, but I forget the punchline of it.
I don't know if there's a big punchline, but the thing was, is when he was approached with marketing Dove soap, he could have made it soap for men.
And now I do remember, but go ahead.
Okay, he could have made it soap for men with dirty hands. And he probably would have sold you know, quite a few bars. But instead, he made it for women with dry skin. Now, why did he do that? Well, the reason why is because in his research, in talking to people, he realized that the women were the ones doing the shopping. It would be more appealing to them, and he would sell more bars of soap if he positioned it in a way that was for women. And it was because of his intense research and talking to people that helped him come up with this great ad campaign, which put Dove soap on the map and made it a huge success. So it's so important for us to not just sit back and think we know who our prospects are. Instead, it's better for us to really do the research. You know, Gary Halbert, he used to read the letters that were mailed in from clients and prospects. He would listen to phone calls and talk to people on the phone who had bought certain products. He would even read the mailing list to see the names and addresses of people and where they lived and what type of names they were, because he wanted to intimately know the prospect. So the more that we know the prospect, the better job we can do in creating messages that connect with them, that motivate them to respond.
Yeah, there's an old saying, remember it? Start with the prospect, not the product.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. So that's the one big takeaway that I had from all six legends, was that they were all very adamant about research and how important it is. David Ogilvy, let me share one other thing on this. David Ogilvy always said, research can and will settle arguments. Scientific results don't lie. So he was always big into researching everything, because he knew that the response and the science that came behind it and from it would ultimately make it clear as to, here's what we need to do.
Absolutely. Now, do you have any questions queued up?
I do. I've got a couple here. I'm going to go ahead and put the first one in the queue.
Okay.
Hold on one second here. Hello, do we have someone on the line with us? Oh, they might have just hung up. Let me try another one here.
Okay.
We'll see how technology works.
Hi, Peter Fogel. Was wondering why short catalog copy works for nutraceutical supplements, and as opposed to long copy that we have to write 24-page magalogs to sell one vitamin, but yet in catalog copy, things are sold much quickly with shorter copy. Can you explain that, Bob?
Craig, do you want to take that one?
I'll take a stab at it. I mean, I think one of the things is when you're mailing catalogs out, in most cases, you're mailing to previous buyers. And so there's a different level of connection with them. They've already purchased something from you in the past, so they're more likely to purchase from you again. You're able to get away with shorter copy. The long copy that you're talking about, if you're trying to sell, say, one supplement and you're going to cold prospects, you have to convince them of a lot more things and really connect with them in order to get them to respond. Now, once they're a customer, we usually can get away with selling, you know, a shorter piece that has, you know, a bunch of different cataloged items in there and having shorter messages because they're already a buyer of yours.
Yes,
Bob, is there anything you want to add to that?
No, except catalogs don't follow a lot of the classic rules of direct marketing. And like one of the rules of direct mail is you can only sell one thing in a mailing. Well, a catalog is a mailing, and it sells 80 things. So, you know, it doesn't quite operate as traditional direct marketing. And a lot of the reason is what Craig says, it goes to existing customers. And another one's if you were to measure the response rate in sales of each product in the catalog, it would be extraordinarily low, but the total, will make it profitable. So, Craig, we'll take another call. But first, I know your book with Brian Kurtz, Advertising Solutions, gives the principles of six of the legendary writers. Who are the six?
So the six are, we started with Claude Hopkins, and then there is Robert Collier, John Caples, David Ogilvie, Eugene Schwartz, and Gary Halbert. So those are the six big ones.
And you can buy this in a bookstore, but have you set up something where if they buy it, they can get a lot of extra stuff that you can't get in a bookstore?
I do, we have. And thanks to you, you've actually helped contribute to this. If you go to thelegendsbook.com, we've set up an amazing page that's going to talk about a bunch of different free resources that you're going to have access to. Old Gary Halbert videos that are rare and you won't find anywhere else. Gene Schwartz videos of David Ogilvie. We have what we call the ultimate online swipe file. It's a swipe file that has it goes back 100 years, and it has 128 pages of swipes from every one of these legends. You can go back and see pieces that were written by Robert Collier and David Ogilvie and Gary Halbert, and they're great examples of ads that we should look at and pattern ourselves after today, you know, use them in our own advertisements. And then, thanks to you, Bob, we have the Scientific Advertising Illustrated and Annotated by Claude Hopkins, which you've graciously allowed us to give away as a bonus, too. So if you just go to thelegendsbook.com, follow the instructions, you'll have access to all these amazing resources, which are very useful in your marketing methods today.
Now, you mentioned the term swipe. What Craig's referring to is you collect promotions that you either know are successful or that have something in them that you think makes them powerful, and you save the collection for reference. And when you're looking for an idea for your next promotion, you don't plagiarize it. That's illegal. You don't copy it, but you use it as inspiration. For example, Gene Schwartz, I don't know if you remember this one, had an ad that said so simply, "Why haven't more TV owners been told these facts?" And I have used that so many times. Why haven't more dentists been told these facts? Why haven't more accountants been told these facts? So, you know, I'm not plagiarizing him, but I'm using him as a model. And Mark Ford calls those archetypal headlines, which means you can use them in many other situations. Do you have another call or two? Question or two?
Yep, I sure do. Let me go ahead and go to the next one. Hello, do we have someone else with us? Hello.
Yes, hi there. My name is Shimantika Kumar. I write on sustainability, this is actually, my question is about feeling deadline pressures when doing research. You know, you talked about one type of research, which is actually talking to the prospect or someone in the position of your potential prospect. What I'm wondering is, how do you balance between do the balancing act between doing secondary research, which is reading up about something, and or spending time talking to a prospect when you know you've got to come back and actually do your writing and you have a deadline hanging over your head?
You want to take that, Craig?
Yeah, I'll give a few tips and thoughts on it, but Bob, I'll also look for you on this one too. You know, I think the toughest thing is when you are working on a deadline is how do you incorporate everything. I mean, hopefully, you know, an ideal world, you know, ideal situation, we want to have as much time as possible to research everything fully. I mean, the key, as I mentioned, to all six of these legends was how important research was to every single one of them. Not only with the prospect, but, you know, in David Ogilvie's case, he talks about reading engineering reports to find this amazing headline and this big idea. So I don't know if I've got a great answer when it comes to how much time you spend on each. I think ultimately you've got to research as much as you can until you feel like you've got a clear direction. Bob,
you go online for two reasons, I think. One is to get a fact you need to know. Like if you say elephants are an endangered species, you want to know how many are left. You go online for that. The other one is to go online is to find source material and then read it and discover facts you weren't looking for. That was the great thing in the old days about a library. If people know, you go to a library or a bookstore and you stumble across stuff you weren't looking for. So that, you know, that, and you can do that on the internet, printing out documents and going to websites, and you'll come across stuff you didn't know you were looking for. The live interviews, the primary research, one of them is to get answers to questions you can't get with online research. Like years ago, I was hired to write a direct mail package for a medical magazine, a professional medical magazine for pediatricians. I don't really know what's important to pediatricians. Now, I guessed it's that they all went into it because they love children. And when I interviewed some of the subscribers, guess what? They said a lot of them don't love children. They like children, but they're not as passionate about children as I am. I'm crazy about kids. I love playing with kids. I was so happy when my kids were little. But they just want to take care of family, kids and their families. But it's not quite the same thing about being gaga over babies and kids as I am. So you get surprises. So we've come at the top of the hour. Craig, any last thoughts or tips or techniques you want to give us?
I wish we had another hour, Bob. I think we could go through dozens of other things. But I think that the biggest thing is there are things from the past that we can learn and apply today. And it's foolish to just go off of today's world of just thinking through, you know, Facebook and Twitter and these short little messages, when the reality is these old messages from the past are still working today, and we should really wrap our heads around them and try and understand them and see how we can apply them, because there's so much we can learn and our marketing will be so much better if we do. So I just encourage everyone who's listening to go to thelegendsbook.com, check out all the free information you're going to get. I would love for people to buy our book, The Advertising Solution, and I think that you'll be glad you did.
Yeah, and I've read it, and it's fantastic. And you'll also, when you do go there, as Craig mentioned, you'll get a version of scientific advertising, which I just put together as an e-book, and it's all the original text. I just added samples of illustrations from Hopkins and other advertising, you know, their ads that meet his principles, as well as some explanatory notes. So, guys, I want to thank you for joining us. Craig, I thank you for spending time with us. This was incredibly useful, and you are one of the most experienced direct mail people and direct marketers out there. So I want to say thanks and goodbye to everyone.
Great. Thanks, Bob. Appreciate having everyone on the call today.
Thanks, Craig. Bye-bye.